just to say a couple words about Sumaya. He's a consummate molecular physiologist, so we're really lucky to get him. I was kind of wishing I had a picture of him, because he's so much at home in the laboratory. So he's that's probably where he is now. I don't know, but without further ado, I'll just launch into this. This really is kind of about two things. The one is I want to give some background about flooding stress, hypoxia, and this is in corn. This is in the corn context. And then talk a little bit about signaling and how the plant senses, or how we think the plant senses impending hypoxia. Because the problem with plants as opposed to animals, you know, what do you do when you're sitting out in the sun? You get too hot. You just get up and you go into the shade. Or if someone throws you into the swimming pool, you swim over to the side. But when the plant gets flooded, it can't run away. And another thing, as all of these organisms that inhabit the land plants and animals have gotten much bigger through evolution as a way of fighting and resisting desiccation tolerance or desiccation. And as they get bigger, animals developed a circulatory system so that we can transport oxygen to our cells. But plants can't do that. They don't have a circulatory system. So plants carry out a lot of aerobic respiration, but they have to tolerate hypoxia more so than most animals. This is a very practical problem. This Somali farmer was depending on this corn. This is his cornfield, and he was going to feed his family with this cornfield. But, you know, he's not going to get any corn from that. And this is a record of the climate anomalies that occurred in 2007. We're not going to bring up 2008 and 9 because you all remember those, but we're coming into an escalating series of climatic events. These green patches here, these are flooding events that occurred in 2007. And it was worse this year. And so what this talk is about is one kind of stress. You know, we have drought stress. We all know that you can't grow plants without water. In 2007, we had a lot of drought stress. 2010, we had a lot of drought stress. But the other side of this is if the plants get too much water, they can't get the oxygen they need. They can't do the gas exchange. It's only going to get worse. This is a record of 2000, 2001, 2002, showing the percent of food emergencies caused by flooding. And I'm sure that Tara will elaborate on this more tomorrow in the soybean context. But in terms of maize and rice, they figure that as the temperature goes up, not just drought will occur, but more and more flooding is going to occur. And with every increase by a degree in temperature, we're losing some decrease in yield, especially in rice. Rice cannot accommodate temperature extremes very well. Neither of these crops. Well, rice can tolerate flooding, but corn certainly can't. Again, plants are able to induce tolerance, and so sublethal effects of many of these different things will induce mechanisms in the plant that allow it to survive. For example, when the plant is faced with osmotic stress, and this is something that that Hank is going to talk about under his, in seed priming, and Kyle Rushing will talk about this too. The plant accommodates by putting more solutes into the cytoplasm so that it can pull water into the cell. Likewise, other kinds of stresses, like hypoxic stress, cause an adaptation. Now, just to go over the mechanisms, the biochemistry of the plant real briefly, food in the form of glucose is processed by a reaction called glycolysis in the cytoplasm, and it produces pyruvate, which is an energy intermediate, and that energy intermediate is transported into the mitochondrion, where it undergoes two main pathways, this what's called the citric acid cycle. And then electrons from that citric acid cycle go onto the membrane, the inner membrane of the mitochondria, and they're processed through a series of electron transfers that produce energy, a large amount of energy for the cell. But it's a very dangerous process. And when hypoxia occurs, or when these electrons pile up at ubiquinone here, plants have a safety valve that animals don't have, and that safety valve is called the alternative oxidase. And the alternative oxidase allows these electrons to be safely transported to oxygen in pairs so that they don't cause partial reduction of oxygen. When the plant senses anoxia or hypoxia, changes start to occur in it. The alternative oxidase is reduced in activity, and glycolysis is ramped up. This is another way of looking at glycolysis or drawing glycolysis. Glucose is processed to pyruvate, and in plants, two enzymes. Subhaya loves to click on things, by the way. But two enzymes are induced: pyruvate decarboxylase and alcohol dehydrogenase. The plant produces alcohol by a pathway, and alcohol is able to diffuse out of the cells, because again, plants don't have a circulatory system, so they can't produce lactate, which animals pull electrons off of pyruvate and they make lactate, but that's very detrimental in plants. What we see in plants is that alcohol dehydrogenase is induced by very moderate decreases in oxygen tension. 15% oxygen is nothing in terms of flooding stress or hypoxic stress. This is very modest, but in just a few hours, this is hours long here, just a few hours, in this is a dot plot here, in a few hours, we get a strong ADH signal. It's a little puzzling, because why would the plant must have a pretty sensitive way of sensing this, because it doesn't take much. And this work, by the way, I forgot to mention, this work was done at Marty Sachs' lab before. We didn't do this at Valent Biosciences, but Subhaya hasn't been there that long. This is work that he did with Marty Sachs. And I wasn't involved in the work here. I'm just trying to report on it because he couldn't be here. Subhaya thought that calcium might be involved in the messenger about oxygen tension. And so that was the line of research that they pursued there. They used a line of corn cells, P3377. And the reason they used this particular line is that it seems to behave in a fairly normal way. In many corn cell lines in the laboratory and tissue culture are already inducing lots of alcohol dehydrogenase because they're damaged in some way. This was more of a normal behaving line. And their technique was to use a dye called Fluor-3, which senses calcium in the cytoplasm. This is a control here. And under anoxia, they found that they got a lot of calcium release in the cytoplasm. These black spots here are mitochondria. So what he found is that the calcium release was correlated spatially with the location of the mitochondria. So what they decided that was going on is that calcium was released from the mitochondrion into the cytoplasm. And they also did some work with a mitochondrial calcium probe. And I think what they showed here was that there was a decrease in the amount of calcium in the mitochondria themselves. What they found is that at the onset of hypoxic stress, the cytoplasmic calcium very rapidly, and these are minutes here, very rapidly went up to what is a very high level in the cell, dangerously high levels in the cell. But if they poison the cell with a dye called ruthenium red, which inhibits calcium action, or calcium transport, I'm sorry, they did not see. Now notice the scale is completely different here. It's a little bit confusing. This whole scale is all down here in this very bottom part. Not only did they not get any rise in calcium in the cytoplasm, they got some gradually diminution in the calcium level. And this graph here is this is aerobic, and this is anoxic, and this is the concentration of ruthenium red going along here. This shows the concentration of alcohol dehydrogenase. Notice under aerobic conditions, there is essentially no or very little alcohol dehydrogenase, and then but under anoxia they got a high signal, but at higher levels of ruthenium red that signal was abolished. GRP is just a glycine rich protein, which is a marker of how much RNA is present in their material, in their extract. They could also do this in intact seedlings. These seedlings are fully aerobic, and these seedlings were made hypoxic by 2 hours submergence. Now, for maize, 2 hours is nothing. 2 hours is not a very stressful thing. But just 2 hours, the ruthenium red treated seedlings were practically killed. And now this is taken about a week later after the treatment, so that's why they're so big. They started out being small seedlings like this. This one was completely ruined and inhibited, but the rest of these grew up. The ruthenium red without hypoxic stress didn't hurt them at all. After much, and I don't know all the details of how they came to this, but it's important in calcium signaling that the calcium be pulled back out of the cytoplasm, because that much calcium is going to be detrimental to the plant. So what they found was a calcium ATPase, which is a calcium transporter. The CAP1 is the gene that they found, and the reason it's an ATPase is that it uses ATP to transport the calcium out of the cell. And now most animals have a calmodulin-driven calcium ATPase. Now calmodulin is a molecule that enhances and mediates calcium signaling in cells. Animal cells have a particular kind of ATPase that's completely different than most plant. Most plants do not have calmodulin binding domains. But surprisingly, the maize calcium ATPase that they discovered does have a calmodulin binding domain. And so in that sense, it looks like some of the animal proteins that regulate calcium homeostasis. In order to confirm the work confirm the function of this gene, what they did is they got some yeast that is deficient in calcium ATPase, and the yeast is unable to grow in low calcium media. So they grew this yeast on plates that contain EGTA, which is a powerful chelating agent. It ties up calcium. So the way this works, they had 6 different versions of the yeast, and they had wild type with just the plasmid vector. They put these plasmid vectors into the yeast. They had the wild type with just the vector, or the wild type with the vector including the calcium ATPase gene that they discovered. And they also had other versions. These red ones are the yeast mutant that's unable to function without at low levels of calcium because it's lacking a calcium ATPase. So they had the mutant with the calcium ATPase. These are two different kinds of mutants. It's with the calcium ATPase or with just the plasmid, and then the other mutant with the calcium ATPase or just the plasmid. And this is on a galactose-inducible promoter. So the gene is turned on by galactose. Glucose can serve as a carbon source, but it cannot turn on the gene that's in this plasmid. So what they found is, under glucose, the wild type grew fine, but nothing else would grow. This is probably just an artifact here. It didn't grow well anyway. But when they used galactose to turn on that promoter, what they found is only the constructs that included the calcium ATPase gene would allow the yeast to grow. You see right here? And again, some of you who are a molecular biologist maybe can help me complete the story if I've left anything out. So the CAP1 gene seems to protect cells from unregulated calcium rise. And again, calcium homeostasis and the redox status of the cells is very, very critical. Again, this is anoxia after, this is a control, this is withholding oxygen for 2 hours, 4 hours, and 24 hours. Now, notice the CAP1, it starts to go up, but then it starts to go down. I think that probably at this point, very little metabolic activity is occurring in the plant. And this is just, again, this is the constitutive marker of how much material they have. So when oxygen goes down, it pushes calcium levels up. But it can't keep going up. This is the adaptive response, how the plant senses and gets ready for the impending hypoxia. If it were to keep going up, it would kill the cell. So the CAP1 serves to transport this back out and maintain cellular homeostasis. Much like chilling injury, when you stress a root with hypoxic stress, if you do it for 24 hours, it will survive, but if you do it for 48 hours, it will become rapidly necrotic. And Subbiah made this more visible by staining it with Evans Blue, a stain that permeates dead tissue. He could also do this in intact seedlings. If he cut off the root tips before flooding, he got better survival of the whole plant. And his theory about this is that, it's twofold. First of all, he does this by immersing them, putting them in a mason jar and sealing them up. If you remove that highly metabolically active root tip, the whole system becomes hypoxic more slowly. His other thought is that if you take the liquid that you soak these in, and it's sterile material, they're very careful to sterilize this, and then you reuse the liquid, it's more harmful. There's some material produced that leads to harm. And he thinks that that material is transferred up the ceiling, up into the ceiling. And kills the chute too. Okay, so in conclusion for this part, they also think that there's a role for glutamate decarboxylase that helps modulate the cytoplasmic pH. Cytoplasmic acidosis is really a problem in corn under flooding. So GAD activity is ramped up very quickly when you flood. And then this seems to be associated with calmodulin activation. Only the root shoot axis specific form of this was. So there seems to be something there. I don't know too many details, but gamma aminobutyric acid, which is the product of GAD, that in itself will enhance survival, and they think that it serves as an antioxidant role. In conclusion to this part of the talk, CA is part of the signaling pathway for oxygen deprivation. Mitochondria are critical for sensing, which you might expect because that's where the metabolic action is. CAP1 is involved in maintaining and restoring homeostasis after the signal. GAD may be involved in pH homeostasis. Intensely, metabolically intense energy systems, organs in the seedling, are what really contribute to cell death. And this is what we see in chilling, too. One of the mysteries about this is the role for the alternative oxidase. You know, I've always kind of wondered, why would the plant have such an inefficient thing? Why would it skip all that oxygen transport and energy? But what it does is it removes that excess reducing power as a kind of a safety valve to prevent the formation of reactive oxygen species. It allows the TCA, or the citric acid cycle, to keep functioning and to maintain some precursors, even if the mitochondrion isn't functioning properly. One of the things they did was they made constitutively expressing lines that would overexpress the alternative oxidase. And these things showed improvement. It's a little fuzzy. It's hard to see this, but at 12 degrees, now 12 degrees is not a very stressful temperature for Arabidopsis, but they could show improved survival of Arabidopsis under these conditions. The antisense was tended to be lethal. The wild type could not handle this stress. The overexpressing lines were a little bit better. Some people, Hockart et al., cloned the alternative oxidase into human cells. Kind of a perverse thing to do, but it's very, very interesting. Animals don't have an alternative oxidase, but when they did that, they could show improved survival when they produced a shower of free radicals, reactive oxygen species, using Annamycin. Same thing with cyanide. Minus cyanide, it didn't matter which genotype, with or without the alternative oxidase gene, but when they poison the system with cyanide, which blocks oxygen, blocks the passage of oxygen electrons to oxygen, the alternative oxidase gene was instrumental in protecting those cells, just like it does plant cells. The mystery in this, back to the how the plant senses. This is ours, and then this is the oxygen concentration, and this the intensity of these spots indicates the alcohol dehydrogenase gene. It can't be. The cytochrome oxidase cannot be sensing this because it's so good at reacting with oxygen. It would never see this kind of this level. It must be the alternative oxidase that's doing the sensing here. And so, in a nutshell, the scheme that they developed was that as oxygen tension goes down under flooding or any kind of hypoxia, the ability of AOX to process or react with that oxygen goes down also, because it's not very avid. It senses this at a fairly, only a modest reduction in oxygen tension. That causes the levels of reactive oxygen species to go up. And again, this is the primordial stressor, the thing that could kill the cell. But at modest levels, it doesn't kill the cell because plants have adapted to this. And the signal that's produced is calcium. The calcium is transported to the nucleus, resulting in gene expression of things that protect against this. And this is, these are Western blots. This is a record of protein expression. And this is the, this lane here is the alternative oxidase. This is the alcohol dehydrogenase. And frankly, I forget what ANT is. Does anybody know what ANT is? Well, it's some other protein associated with hypoxic tolerance. And so what happens here is that as time goes on, and this is the root tip. This is where the real action is in the root tip. And as time goes on in hypoxia, you get induction of ADH, and then you get decline in production of AOX because it's not being used, it's not doing anything. And you get that in these other organs too. And just very briefly, he did a lot of work poisoning the alternative oxidase with salicyl hydroxamic acid, which is an inhibitor of the alternative oxidase. And he found that as you increase the concentration of SHAM, for a while you start to increase the amount of alternative oxidase produced because the plant's trying to compensate for that. Same with propylgallate. At increasing concentrations, this is also another AOX inhibitor. You start to push more production of AOX. If you go high enough, then things start to fall apart too. And he found that these AOX inhibitors trigger a rise in mitochondrial reactive oxygen species. This is a fluorescent dye. I think it's a fluorescein. It's a fluorescein ester that goes into the cell, and it's activated by reactive oxygen species. And this is the control. And as you go down, you see that these hot spots correspond. And I won't go into the details here, but they correspond positionally to where the mitochondria are. And if you poison it with Annamycin A or SHAM or propylgallate. And they also found that epsilon, something that functions as a glutathione peroxidase mimic, this is the structure of epsilon here. This is very, these compounds are very interesting, very poisonous, but very interesting. This abolishes the induction of ADH, probably because it snaps up the reactive oxygen species. And ruthenium red also suppresses ADH induction by propylgallate. And I have to hurry through here because we're about out of time. In a nutshell, the rebound is critical. The control of reactive oxygen species by enzymes that are induced, and then the control of calcium levels, again, induced calcium ATPase. All this goes back to maintaining cellular homeostasis. And so the basic message from Subbiah's work is that inhibitors, AOX inhibitors and hypoxia both do the same kinds of messaging in the cells. And it seems to be associated with an increase in reactive oxygen species. Inhibitors of the alternative oxidase and hypoxia, they trigger the production of reactive oxygen species in mitochondria, indicating that, or further suggesting that this is the mechanism of sensing, that reactive oxygen species are the way that it senses. These signaling networks are comprised of both positive and negative feedback loops, because control of the redox status of the cell is really crucial to survival, and glutathione is synthesized as needed. All these things are controlled by these signaling, oxygen sensing signaling loops. And plant cells are masters at being able to fine-tune these responses, much more so than animals, because they don't have the circulatory system or the behavioral mechanisms to allow them to adapt in that way. And so that's the end. I'll try to take questions if you have any. Oh, I thought you might have a question. Okay, thank you very much.